Fugitive. A QM production. Starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball, an innocent victim of blind justice, falsely convicted for the murder of his wife.
It's been quite a while, but at last we are back to once again talk fugitive, and not just talking to, you know, by ourselves, but we're going to be talking fugitive with Kitty, Bobby, and Ken, and hopefully you as well. If you'd like to join in the program, the phone number is 800-407-KSAV, or the email address is talk@ksav.org. That's the email address during the broadcast. Any other time you want to email the host, plural, it's fugitive@ksav.org. Now, tonight we're going to be discussing, we're going to be discussing Landscape with Running Figures, Part 1, and the hosts have asked that if you do want to participate as a caller, do so after the break. You can call sooner if you want, but you'll have to spend a little time on hold. So with enough of that, kicking things off here with the landscape, welcome back to everybody. And Bob, you go ahead.
Thank you, Dave. All righty. When longtime Fugitive fans sit down to watch episode 69 of the series, Landscape with Running Figures Part 1, on November 16, 1965, they are secure in the knowledge that after almost 2.5 years, they know quite a lot about the main characters in this series. Foremost, that Richard Kimball, despite his dreadful lifestyle of living in the streets with little or no money or food and no real support system, will always have his wits about him, that he will always be smart and quick on his feet and find a way out of any situation, no matter how desperate it is, that he will always maintain a positive attitude and his determination to stay free until he can prove his innocence. And perhaps most importantly of all, that he will never make that one fatal mistake that will end the running for good. So when we see at the very beginning of this episode, from a very unique camera angle that is from far away and far above, a solitary figure walking slowly and dejectedly down a back alley through a driving rainstorm that most of us would run through, we have to wonder who that is. And it's not until the camera pans in on his feet, going through the wet pavement, and then up to his rain-soaked face and body, that we realize it is Richard Kimball, only he doesn't look the way we are used to seeing him look. Then when he goes in the back door of another of an endless series of greasy diners to report for his overnight job, probably as a dishwasher, that's usually the case, and he's confronted with a co-worker who warns him that he made the mistake of writing his real name, Richard Kimball, rather than his current alias, Steve Carver, in the sign-out book the night before. The cops have already set up a dragnet for him. We are very surprised, because he never does that. And then we get a close-up shot of Kimball's face, and we're even then for more of a shock. He's no longer the generally well-groomed, clean-shaven, well-dressed, well-fed man of the streets who we are used to seeing, as unrealistic as that may be. This time we see a haggard, drawn, depressed, distraught, disoriented, an exhausted Richard Kimball, who appears either on the verge of a nervous breakdown or on the verge of packing it in and just giving himself up. Now, we've seen him before in desperate situations. We have seen him shot and stabbed and arrested and just everything imaginable. And we've learned to live through all of that, because we know that he's going to find a way out. But to see him this way is really amazing. It's just the beginning of a remarkable two-part episode that turns the world of Richard Kimball upside down and gives us characters we thought we knew, acting and reacting to situations we could never have imagined, and it starts with him. Kitty and Ken, just how disturbing and how shocking is it to see Richard Kimball looking like this and in this state of mind?
Well, I think it's very surprising, because, as I pointed out at one point when we talked, was that this is certainly a very unique beginning of the show, because as you pointed out, we see him looking haggard, and I always found that, well, it's definitely a refreshing change, because normally we see Richard Kimball unemployed, wearing a suit and tie, hitchhiking, and he has money in his pocket. Yet here it is, he appears to be employed, and yet he looks like he just got thrown out of a homeless shelter. So it's definitely a different perspective. And one of the critiques I had of the episode was that I wanted to know, how did he get into this state of being? Because we've never seen him in this state of being. He always had money in his pocket before and always managed to be able to afford a suit when he went hitchhiking.
Well, see, I took that differently, because I thought that the writer was trying to indicate that this is a cumulative thing, that he's been on the road for 2.5 years, and that how long can you do that before you have a mental breakdown? So even though there's no evidence that we see on the screen, because it's the beginning of the story, that something has happened to cause him to look like this, I just looked at it that way. I think when the writer sat down to write, he simply said, well, you know what? Why does he look this bad? Well, he's been on the road for 2.5 years. And how long can you do that? I really don't know. I mean, most fugitives in real life settle down in a place. Some of them get married, have children, and create different lives and live that way for years until they're caught. He doesn't. He just keeps running and running and running and running and running. How long can you do that? Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. You know, the writer, Anthony Wilson, we've got to give him credit.
Oh, yeah.
Because he touched the core of this show, you know, which is Kimball on the run. And also, he got really, well, what I like is the realism, you know, really down to earth.
Well, I agree. I think it is definitely realistic, and it's actually, I think it's a refreshing change. I guess I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of the backstory. I mean, because if you think about it, this is probably more of how he should have looked at various points in the series up to this point.
But if you did not know this series at all, you had never heard of it. It was still on TV. And I came to you and I said, you know what, I saw this show and it's about a guy, he's falsely convicted of a crime, and he's on the road, he never gets to settle down anywhere, there's a guy chasing him and he won't leave him alone. He's got to look behind over his shoulder and behind every corner. You would naturally, I think, assume that he would look like this, would you not?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
The impression I got, you know, with the opening scene is that Kimbo's working in the middle of the night. I forgot what time it was.
I think it was 2 a.m.
2 a.m. So when I looked at his face, right away I kind of identified with him and said, oh, great. It's a miserable night. You know, I'm in the middle of nowhere, really, and I have to go to work at 2 a.m. to make some money. And just the look on his face was, gosh, I was a doctor before, I had a nice hospital, I had a nice house in Indiana, but here I am walking down an alley at 2 a.m. going to work, probably making very little money. And just the look on his face, I think, just told it all.
But I have a question for you, and I had mentioned this on our message board some time ago. So he goes into work, and his coworker tells him, you find out under a different name than the one you're using, Steve Carver. And if I remember correctly, he even says to him, doesn't he say to him that the police have been waiting out front for a couple of days or something?
Oh, no, I think he says that they've been waiting outside all day.
All day, okay. Well, yeah. I have a question. How come they didn't cover the back door?
Right.
How come there's no cops in the back door?
I think it's the middle of the night.
Well, because think about it, Bob. We've seen a lot of dumb cops on this show.
I know, but you know, it's hard to believe because, I mean, I understand the reason, obviously, the writer. I'm always fascinated by fiction. I've never written fiction in my life, but so I don't know what you do when you're writing a story like that and you're faced with that. You know, if the cops are at the back door, he's dead. They've got him because he's so depressed anyway. He doesn't look like he's in any position to run away. So I just wondered about that because you think they put a cop at the back door. Obviously, they know there's a back door, and workers come in that way. They take the trash out back there, and yet they didn't cover the back. Because in the next scene, we see, you know, the cops all over the place. They're driving up and down the street. They're everywhere except where they need to be. So that struck me as a little unusual. But, you know, when you write fiction, you got to kind of overlook stuff like that. Otherwise, you don't have a story. Okay, so I want to get from that into the very first thing we see after this. I mean, his coworker tells him what's going on, and Kimball, though he looks disoriented, has enough wits about him to know that he's got to get out of there. So he turns and he doesn't run down the alley. I'm very struck by this, that throughout this episode, things are very slow. They slow everything down. Kimball doesn't run, he walks. He seems to be so depressed and so exhausted that he can't even run anywhere. He just walks down the street, walks down the alley, He walks away, and the next scene we get, we see a hotel, and we see Gerard come into the hotel lobby, only he's got a woman with him. And who is that woman, Kitty?
It's his wife. We think her name is Anne Marie.
Yeah.
Sometimes she's early. Anne, sometimes she's Marie.
That was early in the series.
Yeah, Barbara Rush. Hey, Dave, I just wanted to let you know you were asking me about the poster I have on my wall that has all the fugitive women. Well, Barbara Rush is one of the women that I put in that poster. She is excellent.
Oh, excellent's one word for it. Yes, I'm acquainted with her. Okay, I'm keeping track of who's up there in the gallery, Ken.
I just love her. I think she should have gotten an Emmy for her guest appearance alone.
But what do we have here? We said her name is Marie at the moment. And we have Marie Gerard. This is the woman that I guess we've seen twice in the series up until now, only as just kind of a piece of furniture in the scene. Anytime Gerard wants to take off, he just takes off, and she seems to have no problem with that at all. He's got some sort of dream marriage in which his wife never objects to anything.
Except we find out it's not exactly a dream marriage.
Exactly, and here you have her all of a sudden showing up, and she's got an attitude, and a very serious attitude. And she does it, you know, Ken mentioned she does a good job here in that opening scene in the lobby right there. She really says almost nothing, but we can tell right away that she's extremely angry. She doesn't even have to make that clear.
Oh, yeah, she's glaring at Gerard.
Right, and then he gets on the phone, and he gets so distracted he can't even sign in to get the room. So she grabs the pen out of his hand, signs it, and says, "Are you coming upstairs?" Well, no, he doesn't answer. He just nods his head, and she goes upstairs. And then we get that great scene upstairs. In their room, in which he walks in, and this one of the things I like about this episode is how everything is different. Everything you expect to happen does not happen. That's what makes it different, because in this particular scene, you expect that she's going to be in there. Gerard's going to walk in. He's going to say, "Listen, I'm really sorry, but they saw him at this intersection, and I've got to go, and you're just going to have to wait here, and I don't know when I'm going to be back." But it doesn't turn out that way. She ends up telling him. She ends up saying to him, "So what have you done? Have you blocked all the streets? Have you?" I mean, so this is the writer's way of telling us that she's been through this too many times.
Well, and not only that,
as well as we do.
And not only that, before they get up there, we also get an inkling as to how obsessed Gerard is, because you hear him on the phone saying, "Oh no, we weren't doing anything important. We were just on a little vacation."
Here's something a woman really wants to hear.
Yeah.
So I like the way some of them, we've got them in the room in which she demands that he not do it this time. But obviously, you know, and I just, there's so many great moments here, the way they look at each other. There's great screen chemistry right from the very beginning between Barbara Rush and Barry Morse. I mean, it's believable to me that they're really married. And even though we've never, you know, she's never been in the series before, because it's played by other women. So she has to come in and create a character out of nothing and convince us that this is a long-standing problem that now has come to a head. And this is, of course, the key element in this whole story, because if it's not for her not going along this time, nothing that happens afterwards would have happened, obviously. And so I think Ken is right. This is a really, really great performance. And, of course, I don't know whether she was even nominated for an Emmy Award. Who knows? I mean, nobody can remember that.
All right. Let me ask a question, if I may.
Yeah.
Bob, now, am I correct here that Barbara Rush is playing Barry Morris's wife?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you, if she's, you know, pretending that she's married to him, I think that's a great, great performance all by itself. We're going to take a break. We've got Rob from Westchester on the line. So when we come back, we'll get him on and continue to discuss the landscape with running figures when we talk a little more fugitive on Retro Radio.
Everybody, I'm Dave White, and with me today are Dr. Phil,
hello,
Homer Simpson,
woo-hoo,
and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Good morning.
These guys are here to help me tell you about my program, Talking Television with Dave White on KSAV.
I have a feeling some bad stuff is about to go down.
Every Tuesday from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time, we have a fun discussion of television past and present.
Is that the truth or a lie?
What do you guys think of my program?
No longer crap. Boring. Outrageous.
And what about my co-host, television guru Tim Carmody?
The drunk pimp. Jerkass!
But don't take their word for it. Tune in and join in every Tuesday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time on KSAV.
And speaking of my favorite program, Talking Television with Dave White, stick around tonight. We're going to be discussing Gilligan's Island. And if we had time, I'd sing the theme song for you. But we don't, because I want to find out from you guys about the candy machine. Didn't the candy machine have something to do with this episode?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we'll get to that. But listen, let's bring on Rob from Westchester. And Rob is going to join in the discussion with the moderators, Kitty and Bob and Ken. So, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Greetings, guys, and Kitty.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Rob.
How you doing?
Hello,
good.
Rob. Great review you wrote. I liked it very much.
Thank you. Yours, too. Well, unbelievable program episode, isn't it?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's the best one of the series. I don't know that everybody agrees with that, but...
Well, it's kind of hard not. Yeah, I guess I could see somebody being critical of it, but I can't see how anyone could question it. Arguably, one of the best of the series. I think it's the best overall. But you know, as you said, it turned everything upside down and it showed us things we'd never seen before.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I when you have a long running series and you watch it. This one at this point where we're at now is 2.5 years old. That was 4 seasons. And things begin to look the same after a while. I mean, even if you really love the show, and even if you don't care if they do the same story week after week, except with a little variation, and what I really treasure is those moments, and you don't often get them, when a series dares to change everything. They just come up with a story all of a sudden, whether it's the writer or the producers or whoever decides that they need something new, and they do something different because you're just jolted out of that complacency that you get when you see the same thing week after week after week. And that's why I said at the beginning, you know, we're used to seeing Kimball do these certain things and look a certain way. And when this starts, it doesn't look that way any longer. It just is, it's very, very shocking.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I was trying to point out in my review right from the beginning, which was that just the way the episode opens with the music comes in very dramatically,
yeah.
And then we have the torrential downpour, and we have Kimball in this unbelievably, you know, this desperate state of mind. We've never seen that before, and if you compare that to, say, something like Nightmare at North Oak, which also opens up very dramatically with the nightmare sequence, but to me, that was a more of a sanitized opening, and Kimball's
right.
In his suit and tie, and everything's neat and clean. And then he goes on to be a hero and save people, and it's kind of a typical, you know, Kimball program. And right from the get-go in this, we know that he is not going to be a hero in any town in this story, and he is not going to have a love interest in this story, that he is down and out, and we're told that right from the beginning. And it just hooked me right in the first opening 30 seconds.
Yeah, I agree. This is a survival story. You know, a lot of the other stories are either you're helping somebody or a woman's involved, but this is a survival. Kimball
right.
has to, you know, deal with the situation he's in, escape town, you know, and all that. We have all the following scenes.
Well, and speaking of helping somebody, ironically, in this instance, you have little kids who end up helping Kimball. And the reason why one of the kids ends up not ratting Kimball out is because Gerard can't get the candy machine to work to bribe the kid with.
That was an excellent scene, and I thought Barry Morris was just unbelievable in that few minutes in there, because he really was working the kids very well, and he almost had them, and it just showed the range of his acting abilities.
Well, that's a very well-directed scene because it's so subtle, really. It's really very understated. In other words, you got a situation where Kimball, is desperate. He's got to go somewhere, so he runs into this building in this incredibly decrepit-looking laundry room. It absolutely looks awful, and he's got nowhere to go. So there's three kids in there, and he has to depend on them. I mean, where's he going to go? He's trapped right there. He can't go back outside. And one of the kids knows that there's a room next to that room, and that's locked, but he knows how to get in there, and he puts Kimball in there. And this whole thing is very understated. There's a lot of suspense here over not things that do happen, but things that don't happen. I mean, you don't get this great... Of course, then you get this wonderful moment here where Kimball is in this other room. There's one little broken pane of glass. Gerard comes in and slowly walks over there and looks through the glass. These moments in the series, in this story, and in other ones in the past and to come yet, where they're on opposite sides of the wall and just within inches of each other, are just classic moments. I mean, you can't get any better than that.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And the thing that I was really impressed with in this episode, and similar to other episodes, but particularly this one, was how well they used the suspense mechanism. We talked about comparing some of this to Alfred Hitchcock, and there's a lot of Hitchcockian similarities in this episode. Hitchcock, I always remember reading about him. He said if you put two people in a room and have them having a conversation and all of a sudden a bomb blows one of them up, that's a surprise. But if you put two people in a room having a conversation and you show a bomb ticking at one of their feet, that's suspense.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
that's what we have in this scene, is knowing that Kimball's in that room and having Gerard come in and just very quietly go about his business builds more suspense than if he came in kicking the door with guns blaring.
Right.
How about the acting of David Janssen through this whole scene? I've seen this episode three times.
Right.
And you look at David Janssen, and he walks in there, sees a kid, so he has to have a look of, I'm just another guy. And then he needs help. And the way he deals with the kids, I mean, that's not easy, to be an actor. I wonder how many times they had to do that scene. But David Janssen, he just nailed it
right.
there.
Right.
Yeah.
I also like the way, Gerard comes in and he talks to them. And we know that he's very hard-hearted. He's not, one to have a lot of emotion generally in stories, but he talks in a whisper. He tells the kid, if you tell me a secret, I'll tell you a secret. If you tell me that, then I'll give you something. Then he holds out some money for the candy machine, and like Kitty said, the candy machine doesn't work if you put certain coins in it, and so it really doesn't work. There's also two other moments in that particular scene I really like. One is where eventually the head of the police in the town that he's in, Captain Ames, comes in. And we always see Gerard throwing his weight around. He goes into town, takes over police departments, and just has his way. But this guy comes in and does everything differently than what other people do. You would think he would come in and say to Gerard, listen, don't blow into my town and take over and tell me what to do. I'm running the show here. Instead, he comes in and he says to him, oh, you're Lieutenant Gerard. I'm sure you'll want to cooperate with us because we have everything under control. Didn't you find that most unusual? Because they don't usually do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true. Usually Gerard intimidates them, and I never understand why Gerard can intimidate them, because most cops in local jurisdictions would say, who are you?
Right. This is reverse psychology. This is just coming in and saying, oh, of course, we all have a common interest here. We're trying to catch this guy. So I know that you're not going to stand in our way, right? I mean, you're not going to give us a hard time, right? So Gerard, I love Barrymore. Says he has a great look on his face. And he's taken aback by it completely, like he's not used to this, because he knows that his reputation precedes him, and people know that he's trouble if he hits down. But this guy just walks in, and kind of uses a velvet glove. Don't tell me what to do. We're taking care of it.
I think that scene really ends well, because then when all the police leave and the kids let him out, I think it was great writing on the part of the writer, because when you think about it, most kids would crack seeing all those policemen coming in.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, you know, you got these kids that never waver, and, you know, and the ringleader of them, I mean, he can't be more than about, what would you say, maybe 9, 10 tops. You know, he just kind of thinks it's all a big game, you know. And as Kimball leaves, he says, "What did you do?" And, of course, Kimball just ignores the question.
Yeah, I thought that was odd. You know, I look at that scene many times. Kimball doesn't say anything to the kids, you know, like, "Thanks, guys," or anything. He just walks out depressed.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Well, that's his state of mind. I mean, he appears to be, you know, I used in my review, I said he looks disoriented to me. I'm not quite sure that he really understands early in the story exactly what's going on. Now, we've seen him in a previous episode, Escape in the Black, where he is, you know, his memory is lost. He doesn't even know who he is. But there's something different about this, and that is the fact that he knows who he is, and he understands he's got to leave when he leaves his work there, and he walks down the alley, but that there's some disconnect here for me. That he's not doing what he normally does. Normally, you know, you wind him up and he just runs away. This time you wind him up and he just kind of stands there. And this is deadly. He just can't afford to be doing this. When he leaves that laundry room there, remember, he walks down the street. You notice how he's walking down the street very calmly, really, with police cars all over the place. I mean, what is he doing? He shouldn't even be out there, because they've got a total dragnet out, and he's just calmly walking down the street all the time in the world.
But, you know, by the same token, you could make the argument that he's trying to blend in. If he's running hysterically through town, that could draw attention to him.
Well, yeah, but
if he just kind of walks with his head down, and the cops are driving by and not noticing, then maybe that might be the easiest disguise.
Yeah, except earlier on, he's told Gerard is pulled up, leave on the phone, that he's given that intersection there that he's at. So we see the signs there when they get there, and that he's already been spotted there previous to this particular time. So I don't think that he can really afford to do that kind of thing. And then, of course, we have that at the end of the second act, we have that great moment where Kimball is up against the wall and he's got a sign over his shoulder that says condemned. Now, you got to love that.
And, Bobby, also at the end of the scene when Gerard left the where the kids were, he just collapsed in his little spell there up against the wall.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We're getting we get the signal there that his state of mind is not, you know, what we've seen before. We've never seen him do that before.
Right. A man on the run like that cannot afford, every second is precious, because he's got to, you know, and so that's why I said at the beginning of the show tonight, that's the difference in this. It does not look like any other episode, simply because he is not like he used to be. And that's when you change that. When you change that at the beginning, you've changed the entire episode. So by the time we've been through the first two acts, you can see that this is a completely different episode. This is like nothing that has ever come before. It's not a traditional fugitive episode. It's not just, you know, Kimball goes to work somewhere, everything's fine, somebody notices him, Gerard comes down, he runs away. It's not quite that simple, not this time.
All right.
It's different.
All right, and that brings us, we're out of time because I hear the theme music going. Rob, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. Nice talking with you all.
All right, and do so in 2 weeks when all of us will be back for part two of Landscape with Running Figures. Am I right?
Well, actually, it'll still be part one, but act three and four.
Okay, so it'll be part two of part one with acts three and four with
That's
the
it.
Question... Will Kimball get the candy machine working? So thanks a lot to everybody. Stick around for Perfectly Frank and Talkin' Television in 1 hour on tonight on KSAV, and be back in 2 weeks to talk Fugitive on Retro Radio.